I'm going to go to Mayor Williams, and I think the themes, there are definitely common themes coming through, and obviously Washington, D.C., probably the least represented of American cities, a very strange relationship with the federal government.
Yeah, well, thank you, everybody, for having me here, and it's particularly an honor to be able to be here with Bruce, who I've known for some time, and he's certainly been just a great fan and scholar and contributor to cities, and people like Richard Barron, who I've worked with a long, long time ago from St. Louis. And as I travel around the country, I always talk about St. Louis because I love that city, and my wife is from there, and he's done great things there in St. Louis. So, you know, our cities and our country have had a period of expansion. They've had a period of decline, as I always say, we're trying to figure a way to get out of that period of decline into this new age that is the title for this conference and enter what I would call the century of cities. But as we all know, there are many obstacles and challenges to that, and certainly Tony has mentioned them and Esther has mentioned them. Washington, D.C. is a unique city. We could be a neighborhood in New York. We're more like, you know, and people in my city want to compare us to New York. I always compare, we're more comparable to a city like Boston or San Francisco in size. We're the center of a metropolitan region. We're actually, in actual numbers of the city proper, a relatively small city, which doesn't mean that the tail can wag the dog, but we're relatively small. And you know, my remarks are always brought to you by the story of Washington. And if we want to talk about planning and governance, there's no more unique and ironic example than Washington, D.C. Because first of all, Washington, D.C., and I've shared this with some of you in its good sense, is a remarkable example of a planned city. You know, the original L'Enfant plan, which was based on Versailles, as you travel around Washington, D.C., you see evidence of a L'Enfant plan. People think that it was based on Paris, but we all know it wasn't really. And then 1900, the McMillan plan, you drive around the Washington Mall, you're actually looking at evidence of the McMillan plan. Senator McMillan knew governance and planning, and so he cloaked the plan by entitling it a bill to improve recreation in the district, and meantime completely revolutionized its planning. So he did that. So here we are in year 2000, and I'm mayor, and one of the goals I set for myself was to develop a new plan for the district over the next 100 years, not given to the district by the federal government, but generated by the citizens of the district. And, you know, I know, Esther, you're right, it's very, very difficult for citizens to actually motivate and drive a plan, but that's our ambition in our city. When you're talking about citizens, I look at citizens as like nuclear power. I mean, you know, properly channeled and harnessed, nuclear power can power the city. And if it isn't channeled in harness, it can destroy the city. So it's, you know, it's my goal to try to challenge, to try to channel and inspire that citizen power to drive a new agenda for our city. Now, this is particularly important in our city to give citizens that charge, because we are a city that doesn't have the basic franchise. So all, you know, if you want to see what the federal government's view of a city is, we're actually a great example. Washington, D.C. was started in 1800. Before the national capital moved from here in New York City, actually, to Washington, D.C., it was housed in Philadelphia. While the national government was in Philadelphia, as was true to form after every war up until World War II, when veterans fought a war, they were given a McDonald's Happy Meal ticket, and they were told, thank you very much, thank you for fighting. Well, needless to say, after every war around the world, veterans didn't like this, and so they always revolted, they always rebelled. Well, after the Revolutionary War, when the veterans were given the Happy Meal ticket, they were revolting, so they made a run on the national legislature in Philadelphia. They got on the phone, or whatever you did at the time, and they said to Pennsylvania, help us, help us, help us, they're making a run on the legislature. Pennsylvania said, we actually agree with the veterans. So they decided, you know what, when we move down to Washington, we're going to put the district government completely under the auspices of the Congress. So in the Constitution, the district government is completely under the control of Congress. And from the very beginning, for about 80, 90 years, there was a mayor and a council in Washington, D.C. I've read all the histories. They all complained about the lack of a vote in the Congress, a lack of a vote for president. This happened all the way up until President Johnson. There was finally a vote for a mayor in Washington, D.C., and so now I am the fourth mayor of Washington, D.C. So here we have a city where we don't have a basic vote, a city where the federal government up until recently has actually run the city, a city where the planning for the city was done for the city by the federal government. And you want to talk about dollars hemorrhaging the city because of the presence of the federal government, either owning property or regulating property. Basically, I have a four-engine airplane, as I always say, and I'm running on two engines. Or another way of thinking about it is, here's my restaurant. I can only charge half of you, right, for a meal, but I have to serve all of you. So what's going to happen? All of you are going to complain about the lousy service, and half of you are going to complain not only you're getting lousy service, but you're paying twice the value for it. That's the situation that I face. But we decided what we were going to do is, even though we had all these challenges, even though we had all these obstacles, it was very important to somehow or another engage the citizens in a future vision for the city, recognizing, from in my humble estimation, that when you're a mayor in governance of a city, and this relates to planning, I always go on the 80-20, 70-30 rule. And I would think that Mayor Bloomberg would agree with this, although I've never talked to him specifically about this. You know, so 60-70% of the time, 80% of the time, basically it's the butler function. Basically, you're just taking orders. What kind of meal do you want? You want a steak? I'm giving you the steak. I may not think you need the steak. I may think your cholesterol is too high, but hey, you ordered the steak. How fast can I get the steak to you in just the way you wanted it? But 20% of the time or 30% of the time, you're in business because you believe there's a trustee function. And it's your job to give enough of those dinners out and satisfy your customers enough and keep them happy so that you can work on that 20-30% trustee function. Now, Mayor Bloomberg, and I think he deserves enormous credit for moving through the state legislature and getting control of the schools. That's a trustee function. In my mind, a great example of the trustee function was the privatization of the hospital. We had a public hospital. We were hemorrhaging money in the public hospital. And basically, if you were a poor person in Washington, D.C., you had to wait until you're near death to get lousy service at the public hospital. And so what we did is we cut off the subsidy to the poor person's lousy hospital. But instead of taking that money and putting it into luxury condominiums, as my critics would like to think, we actually took it and we put it into health care. And now, if you considered Washington, D.C. as a state, Washington, D.C. has got more people covered in health insurance than any other state in the United States. And this is in a high-poverty, high-impact urban area. I'm very, very proud of that because we use that trustee function. Another example of the function is the Anacostia Waterfront Initiative. You know, satisfy the customers, satisfy the citizens, give them some short-term objectives that you're going to accomplish, but meanwhile, work toward an agenda of revitalizing the waterfront of the city in an area that's been neglected, in an area that's been forgotten, but in a way that tries to tie the city together. And that's very important in my city. And I would argue to you the planning function is very important to many American cities. I would argue cities worldwide, because my city is a great example of this. It's a very polarized city. I have the richest city in the country by one slant. I have for all you academics, we have a bimodal distribution, which, as you know, means basically the middle of the bell curve collapse. Where the bell curve go? It all went out to the suburbs over the last 30, 40, 50 years, right? So a city like St. Louis, you know, lost, what, over half its population in the last 50 years? Middle of the bell curve left. So we have very rich population, one of the richest populations in the country. I have the highest concentration of poverty in the United States in the same city. One of the most educated populations in the country. I have 40% of my city struggling at a third grade level of reading. Right? So somehow or another, there have got to be examples, monuments on this road or milestones on this road to progress, where you can point to the citizens and say, you know, we are unifying the city, we can believe, we can do things together, even if they seem to be sometimes in a very mundane, elementary way. They're all building blocks toward moving the city forward. I actually happen to think that, you know, the best days of our city are before us. There are many, many challenges, but I think you can bring people together around a common vision and get some things done before they tire of you and run you out of office. Thank you.